Support comes from Catholic Charities. Driven by the message of love your neighbor, Catholic Charities is focused on improving lives in Maryland. Give the gift of love during this holiday season and learn more at cc-md.org/love.
During cancer treatment, I had this wave of permission to do what I had not been able to do before. Permission to eat what I wanted or drink what I wanted, and also permission to accept all of the support.
It's a cocktail, and I need you to start right away, but let me tell you, it's not going to be easy.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Jessica Hankin.
And I'm Laura Wexler.
And this week on the podcast, My Secret Illness, two tales of people doing battle with an undercover epidemic.
So this first story is told by Natalie Froman, and she's a high school English teacher. And I'm not going to say too much because I think her story does it all. I will just say that, just listen.
In 2018, I went to the dentist for a routine checkup, and I happened to mention to the dentist that I had an irritation on the inside of my right cheek and like a little growth. And it didn't really stress me out because I tended to chew the side of my mouth out of anxiety. And so the dentist shined her headlamp into my mouth and said, "Mouth guard, let's do that. And up your anxiety meds," both of which I did. And went back and wore the mouth guard dutifully every night, and woke up, and every morning my cheeks still hurt, and there was still this little bubble in there. So I went back to the dentist, and I said, "Mouth guard's not helping," and they prescribed something called magic mouthwash, which has nothing to do with magic at all. It's a numbing agent, and so it's like drinking liquid denial. Like, that's the way I looked at it. Right. Nonetheless, I took the liquid denial home, and I took it, and things did not get better. In fact, the pain was starting to get worse on the side of my face. Eventually, it had gotten to the place where I needed to go and find a different opinion. So I went to the ENT, and the first thing that the ENT did was prescribe magic mouthwash. I knew, of course, that wasn't going to work. I think he probably did too. At this point, I knew something was very wrong because the pain was really radiating out and to the full area of my face. So next steps were a biopsy, and I waited, and the pain got worse to the point where I couldn't use the inside of my mouth to chew anything, and the pain was pretty excruciating. And then I got the call that no one wants to get. "You have a cancerous tumor on the inside of your mouth." I don't really remember what I said, but I do remember that the ENT said the plan is surgery and then 6 weeks of radiation, so I went into survival mode. And between the time that I got the information about the diagnosis and surgery, it was an excruciating time because the pain just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I could not wait to have surgery. I wanted it to come immediately because when you have a cancerous tumor growing on the inside of your mouth, and you can feel it, you kind of want somebody to take it out, like ASAP, right? So luckily, I had surgery eventually, and the cancerous tumor on the inside of my mouth was removed, and my lymph nodes on my right-hand side were removed, and my margins were clear, and all this was very great and happy. The only thing was that when they removed the cancerous tumor from the inside of my cheek, they also removed my cheek and the entire right side of my face. Of course, I had very little preparation for this. And actually, the fact that my face was replaced by my thigh. That is like medically fascinating to me and revolting and horrifying. I didn't have much time to worry about it, though, because my radiation treatment started. And that's really when I experienced quite a bit of pain that I probably couldn't have imagined. Radiation is essentially burning, so I had very painful burns on the outside of my face and on the inside of my cheek and on my lips. And, of course, I couldn't take anything inside my mouth, so I had NG tube. And I was on high doses of pain medicine. I was on fentanyl patch, and that, like, barely did anything, right? At one point, even ice chips really hurt to touch my mouth. So, and not surprisingly, I started to lose weight. It was at this time that, and when I could think rationally, it was at this time that a wave of euphoria swept over me. I could eat whenever I wanted. I had permission not only to eat, but people were telling me to eat. And this was a kind of amazing moment for me, because for the past 20 years, I've been dealing with an eating disorder, which is all about not eating, right? At least in my case. And my eating disorder started when I was a young kid, but it really manifested by the time I was in high school. I was a competitive soccer player, and my body, I kind of wasn't attached to it. I kind of saw it as a tool, a machine. And I was on the path to get recruited to play D1 soccer. That was my path. And I really needed to get recruited to play D1 soccer because I needed the money to go to college. So I was recruited late in the game to play D1 soccer at George Washington University. Yeah, great. Except for I didn't want to go there. I wouldn't have applied there if it's a great school, no offense, but like I would not have gone there had I not been recruited, and I felt like I was indebted to my body for my college education. I had to control my body and execute my body and keep it fit, and I was just getting really tired of performing. So I went to GW, had a great first season, and I was miserable. I didn't feel like I fit in. I felt like I wasn't worthy of being there. And most of all, I just was tired. And I was tired of all the control and all the training and all the performance. So I made it my mission to get out of the situation. And the way I did that was by using my body as the narrative. I didn't have the language. I didn't know how to say what I was feeling or who to say it to. So I stopped eating. I starved myself. I started taking diet pills. I started over-exercising secretly in the gym so nobody else on the team could see me. I started eating surreptitiously. Everything kind of had this cast of shame around it. And I did a good job. I went home for winter break. I came back. I couldn't play anymore. I had lost probably about 25 pounds. And I was 2 weeks, and I had no energy to play. So mission accomplished. I had starved myself right out of college. I had to relinquish my soccer scholarship, leave college, move back home. And I wish I could say I got treatment right then, because that would have been a good thing. Unfortunately, I didn't. And years went by. And that's kind of the trajectory that my life has taken over the past 20-some-odd years. I've been in and out of inpatient treatment, intensive outpatient treatment, of course, outpatient therapy. I've met with nutritionists. I've met with therapists. I've met with psychiatrists. I've been on every medicine that you've ever heard of. I've been on it. Ask me. I've been on it. And I've been up and down, quite literally and also figuratively. So when I started losing weight during cancer treatment, it was like the gift that I'd always wanted. The problem was is that I had to have cancer to have the gift. During cancer treatment, I had this wave of permission to do what I had not been able to do before. Permission to eat what I wanted or drink what I wanted, and also permission to accept all of the support, the outpouring of support and love that those around me gave me. I wasn't used to that. I had permission to ask for help. I had the permission to be vulnerable. I had the permission to cry. I had the permission to not control myself because I had cancer. I also had permission to cancel my gym membership. I should say, yeah, I enjoyed that. And I remember one time that I went to Starbucks during COVID. It was during the pandemic, and I decided I'm going to get myself a Frappuccino. And this was, like, groundbreaking for me. I was so excited. And so I went to Starbucks, and I got a Frappuccino. It's chocolate chip. It was delicious. I enjoyed it. And it was the first time in I don't know how long that I was able to take something in like that without deep shame or guilt or regret. But again, the problem is, of course, that all of this had really high stakes. So the problem for me, in many ways, is that bodies heal, thankfully. But as my body healed, I kind of watched the permission fade away. Cancer was gone, and so I kind of felt back where I was before the cancer diagnosis in the first place. Because there's no treatment for the eating disorder like there is for cancer. You can't radiate it. You can't pump chemicals into your body. You can take medicine, but it's a really stubborn, stubborn illness. And when I started writing this talk, this was going to be hilarious. It was going to be, no, I'm serious. I'm sorry you missed it. It was going to be a cancer. It was going to be a cancer story, right? About getting diagnosis. I was going to be really funny about this thing with radiation, and then the sort of end, which right now you can see my thigh on my face, and it's been 8 surgeries since the original surgery to get me looking this good. Just saying. And I have my next one in. Oh, no. I have my next one in June. So I realized, though, as I was talking out the story and thinking it through, that I really couldn't tell the public cancer story, the one that is sort of legitimate and people expect to hear, without telling the private sort of secret story about the other life-threatening illness. So this is a story, I think, about the collision of two life-threatening illnesses and the broader battle, which I go through on a daily basis, between being sick and being well.
So just to kind of give the how the sausage is made, when Natalie first submitted for the show, the aspect of Natalie that involves battling an eating disorder, disordered eating, was not something that she was had led with.
Right. She wanted to tell a cancer story.
Yeah.
And more importantly, she wanted to tell a funny cancer story.
And so after Laura got done with her, I mean that in the most like loving and informed way. Like you basically pushed her to take a risk and to be more vulnerable. And
well,
it paid off.
And I was like, there's something here. And I sort of tugged on the thread. And as we were talking and just every time she sort of unraveled a little bit more, I felt like we got closer to whatever the essence of the story was. But I have to say, you know, when she told me this is the first time she ever had talked almost to anybody about her eating disorder, then I felt like, oh my gosh, like, are you sure you want to? I mean, kept saying, like, you don't have to do this. Like, I now really do ask permission to, yeah, like, are you okay with this? I can push you if you want, but I don't have to. And, but she was really, it was a huge thing for her to do and empowering in the way that it is. To, you know, share your burden. And yeah, I hope she continues working with this because I think it is such an important story, the idea that for one kind of illness like cancer, there would be all of this, these people rallying for you and you're a fighter and, you know, cancer's the enemy and all of that. And when you have an eating disorder, it's just much more insidious. It can be more fatal. And it's because it's not publicly sanctioned, it's a much different experience.
Yeah.
And I think that was such an important point that her story made.
Well said. Okay, we're going to take a little break and then we'll have a second story about another individual doing battle with an undercover epidemic. We're back. Eric Anderson is our next individual who's sharing.
Lovely. Love him.
Yeah, he's assistant pastor at the Grace of God Ministries in Baltimore. He's an LGBTQA community advocate. He's the president of the Coalition of Baltimore HIV Providers. He is an administrator and teacher for GOGM, Art Escape Program for Youth. And when he is free, he prays for sleep. So take a listen to Eric.
In 1990, I was 28, living in Dallas as a professional dancer, choreographer, living my best gay life, dancing as if my life depended on it, because it did, because I did no longer want to be in Baltimore. In July of 1990, I get a call from my mom who says to me, Eric, you have to come home because Boo Boo, we affectionately called him my brother Charles, was dying from AIDS. Now, you know, if you don't remember, I remember so vividly that AIDS was that dreadful disease that killed so many of my gay friends, that stopped. It was as if Donna Summers was singing Last Dance, Last Chance for Love. And then the needle on the record made this skirk sound. And all the partying stopped. Now, my brother wasn't gay, but I didn't know then that he was a functional drug addict that shared needles. So my mother's instructions was to get home as fast as I can. But there was no grand jeté. For those who don't understand ballet, it means a big leap to get me in Baltimore in time. And my brother passed before I got there. So I did the funeral thing and ran back to Dallas to continue my life as a dancer. Around about 6 months after my brother's death, I started not feeling well. And you know that one thing about not feeling well, there's a difference of not feeling well. Sometimes, you know, you may have a little cold, but I had just not feeling well where something was just not right. And automatically I thought, oh no, don't tell me I have AIDS. Now, fear is a powerful thing. Fear will simply paralyze you to do nothing. It took me a whole year to go to be tested. I remember going to Cedar Springs in Dallas, that's the gay strip, and this nondescript building. Got inside, and everything was so secretive. You didn't give names, they gave you numbers. I had my blood drawn with the instructions of, they will call me in about 10 days for the results. 10 days of fear, 10 days of hell. I remember going back for my results, and some guy was sitting across the table from me that I can't remember what he looked like. And all I could hear him say was, I'm sorry, your results were positive. He said a bunch of stuff after that, but it was all womp, 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 womp. I was looking above his head out of the window, and there was a bar. And I just simply thinking, damn, I need a drink. Now, in the bar, sipping my first, second, third vodka gimlet, I started thinking, how in the hell am I going to tell my mother this? She just lost her son. I'm going to tell her. And I didn't. I called my sister. See, my sister and I are 2 years apart, and we have always been extremely close. I called my sister and told her the news, and she said, come home. Come back to Baltimore. Johns Hopkins have all these studies going on. Come back. I took the snail way home. It took me 3 years to come to Baltimore. To be honest, I was coming home to die. See, because there was no medication, no treatment, no cure. You just died. And so my family owned this assisted living house. And in the house were six patients and this girl named Debbie. Have you ever just fell in love with somebody the first time you met them? Debbie was beautiful, a beautiful smile, but her spirit was just as beautiful as she was. Debbie and I became instantly friends. One day I was in Debbie's room with her. We was listening to music. And I shared my secret. I said, hey, Debbie, I'm HIV positive. And she whispered, me too. Now, Debbie was already connected with a place called Park West Medical Center. So Debbie was actually in the house because Debbie was just getting off of drugs. And so my sister was telling Debbie that, you know, my sister was a recovering addict and had a few years under her belt and said, Debbie, you could stay here as long as you stay clean and go to NA meetings. So Debbie said, oh, I got this place to go. And she grabbed me by my hand and dragged me to Park West Medical Center. Debbie was an angel sent to me because I was drowning and dying. So she took me to Park West Medical Center. And Park West Medical Center had these support groups for people living with HIV and many people who would die from HIV. And you just learned all that I needed to learn to try to survive. And there was this woman named Anna Blücher who was a social worker. And I just remember her so well because she had such compassion and such love and such empathy. It was all I needed at that time. And then Debbie sent me, introduced me to this doctor called Dr. Donald Barcell, who had the bedside manner of Marcus Welby. Y'all too young, you don't remember. I was getting sicker and weaker. In 1995, I had 95 T cells. And for y'all who don't know about T cells, that's like walking in the middle of the street, slipping on a banana, one foot up in the air, and a speeding truck coming. It was impending doom. I was getting weak. And I remember getting a call from Dr. Barcell, and he said, hey, Eric, there's this new medicine. They call it the antiretroviral, blah, 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 blah. It's a cocktail. And I need you to start right away. But let me tell you, it's not going to be easy. The medicine came. I said, no shit. It was 32 pills a day. Now remember, just not feeling well. Just feeling bad, laying in bed day after day. And just thinking each day, making a new affirmation that if I just can swallow and relax just one more day, just one more day, Eric. That was one of the hardest things I've done in my life. So one day, laying in bed, Debbie at my side, we were watching TV. 6 months later, into my 32-pill-day regimen, Dr. Purcell called and said, hey, there's this new study. You can cut it in half. I did a grand jeté and a few pirouettes. It was as if that statement had changed my whole life. You know, I never thought that I would live to see that type of fear, that type of isolation, that type of death, that type of hopelessness, that type of not trusting the medical system, that type of people turning their backs on one another until COVID came. And I got that too. But guess what? I survived it like I did HIV. So I'm going to close with saying this. Debbie and I were the first peer counselors for HIV at University of Maryland. Debbie left about a year and a half after doing it. I've been there 20 years. I have changed positions so many times. Now I am the eligibility specialist for the grant for Ryan White at the newly named Thrive program. And owe all this to an angel named Debbie. And so I just want to say thank you, Debbie, for your love. Thank you just for being there for me. And I miss you. And guess what, Debbie? I only take one pill a day. Thank you.
I love this story. I love that, as you know, you've heard me say before, but I love when personal stories capture a historical moment.
Yeah.
And this moment of late 80s, early 90s, learning you have HIV, there's no cure. You know, how he describes, like, you know, there was a record playing and the scratch and all. Because people growing up today don't realize there was a time when HIV was fatal,
yeah.
You know, in most cases. But actually, you know, Eric was referred to us through people who work in he works at the Ryan White program at University of Maryland. But I remember talking with some of the folks there and them saying that, like, HIV rates are going up, even though, like, the medicine is around and it's not a fatal disease anymore. There is, like, it's just not a lot of compliance among many people. And I think about Eric and what it would be like to be someone who lived in a time before there was PrEP and all of that, and to be here now. Anyway, it's just, he's a lovely person, and so is Natalie. And both these stories, I think, are so powerful. Thanks. For joining us.
Yeah, for these. Listening, and taking the time to listen.
Yeah. And if you would like to hear more stories from The Stoop, you can visit our website at stoopstorytelling.com. We have lots and lots and lots of stories in our archive. You can also listen to previous podcast episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And we want to thank Maureen Harvey for producing the podcast. And we will be back soon with more stories from The Stoop.